This is the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com, and this is episode 245 as the Cardinals are coming off of a 31-9 loss to the New Orleans Saints. I'm Jess Root from CardsWire.com, USA Today NFL wire site covering the Arizona Cardinals, and my co-host, as always, is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com. Seth, we've got a lot to talk about today. We've got a loss to talk about, but even beyond that, because this is a short week, the Cardinals are going to be playing on Thursday night. We've got the trade deadline that passed. We're going to talk about Kenyon Drake, the addition of him in the wake of some injuries. We're talk about whether or not they should have made some other trades. We're going to talk about what exactly happened against the Saints, what went well, what didn't go well. Talk about some playing time changes, particularly Hassan Reddick, who's got some playing time changes. We'll do some mid-season evaluations, and then we'll not do too much preview, because I know what a lot of you all will be listening to this show. It might be after the game's already happened. So essentially, what the Cardinals must do to win this game against the 49ers on Thursday night. Seth, how is everything for you? And my goodness, are you ready for this quick turnaround? I think this year, not that I play football, it's just as difficult for the writers who are used to a routine of content to have to compact that into 3-4 days, because that's rough.
Yeah, it is, and especially when you have the Cardinals going up against maybe the two most physical teams in the entire NFC. Back to back, that makes things really, really difficult to deal with. It's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. And the Cardinals were not just beat, but they were beaten up on Sunday by the New Orleans Saints, and now they have a team with an even nastier defense and more physical offense that they have to take on Thursday on a short week, like you said. So I guess we'll see what happens and hope for the best.
Spooky stuff. It's Halloween night. The Cardinals play the 49ers. Let's talk about that Kenyon Drake trade, because of all the trades that were kind of out there, there's some who have said that the Cardinals were monitoring the Trent Williams situation, that it was a possibility. Leonard Williams... I know Robbie Anderson was a guy that some of us would have loved to see the Cardinals to acquire. One of the guys on my site wrote how, and this wouldn't have necessarily been a trade, but proposed the idea of going and acquiring Josh Gordon once he is released, or even making a deal for him. But in the end, the one trade that the Cardinals did was the one that I didn't see coming at all. I was starting my morning, and I was like, wait, what? Kenyon Drake to the Cardinals? I mean, okay, I guess that makes sense, but what's your initial reaction to the trade? Because I know it was mostly questioning and negative is kind of the reaction across the board from fans and media analysts alike.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I'm one of those people that, not just because we cover the Cardinals and we have to wait till it's all said and done, but because I know the NFL draft extremely well. I know how to find not just good players, but productive players that can kind of offer help. And when you look at the NFL as a total, trading away 5th through 7th round picks for players that will play, that will give you the opportunity or the ability to contribute is infinitely better than just taking draft picks and kind of throwing them at the wall to see what sticks. I know fans don't like to hear that because everybody assumes that every draft pick is going to be a Pro Bowl, All-Pro, Hall of Fame type player. But the reality is the best kind of, you know, the most likely talent you get from a six-round pick is a special teams contributor a la Rudy Ford, a long-term backup type player, or potentially a kind of flash in the pan, not bad in certain situations type player like an Andre Ellington. Usually they have a short shelf life and things of that nature. And so when you look at the trade for a six-round pick, I don't or potentially a fifth-round pick, I don't mind it because what you're doing is you're getting a player that has rushed for over 1,500 yards in his career, that has over 900 receiving yards in his career. And the list of players drafted since 2000 that have accomplished that, that are drafted in the fifth to seventh round, is 11. So the chance of getting – and there's been over 200 running backs taken in those rounds, by the way, in the last 20 years. So the chance of it happening is, you know, 1%, 0.5%. And so you're getting value that won't – that is unlikely to be there and just – creating better value. And that's kind of how I focus on it. I mean, I tweeted about it, and people their immediate response, and trust me, nobody, and Jess knows this, nobody is harder or thinks less of what Steve Keim has built in Arizona than me. But
it's true. It's true, guys.
This the six round pick thing, I mean, it's just, it's comical to be upset with him about not hitting on six rounders. And I tweeted it out, like, the amount of six rounders the Arizona Cardinals have on their roster is greater than the amount of six rounders that most NFL teams have on their roster. And it's by like two. So, and you remember they drafted two six rounders and kept both six rounders this year. So it's just not something that you see a lot in the NFL. So I get the idea that, oh, we don't want to give up draft picks, but at the same time, they're draft picks. Like they're literally going to be cut 90% of the time.
Well, and here's the thing. You're like, fans are saying, why is Steve Keim trading away draft picks and then turning around and saying Steve Keim's terrible at the draft? So which one is it? So either you would rather he use those picks for a known commodity, or you trust him to draft players that can contribute. Now, the one thing that it is nice to have these late round picks is because they can fill your roster with cheap role players that can last a year or two that you can burn through. And the downside to something like this is that it is for only a half season rental for a player who likely isn't going to stay. And if he stays longer term, it's going to cost much more than what would paying a sixth rounder 1 year to the next year to the next year, even if you cut and draft another one, simply goes like that. Now, for me, it makes sense, especially for a couple of reasons. One, they simply don't have any viable running backs on the roster right now that who can play. Obviously, David Johnson, the severity of his ankle injury has been downplayed significantly, especially when the report came out on Sunday that he is likely to miss Sunday's and Thursday's game. So now it gets to the point where, wait, what is his status with the ankle exactly? Because we know very well Cliff Kingsbury downplays purposefully every single injury and won't give any sort of timetable, day-to-day, blah, 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 day-to-day. Chase Edmonds then injures his hamstring. Kingsbury says, oh, probably not because it's a short week, but if it weren't a short week, we'd probably wait and see. And yet Tom Pelissero is coming out and reporting that he's going to miss several weeks. The addition of Drake tells us one thing for sure. They don't plan on having Johnson or Edmonds for, or maybe even one of the two, for a significant amount of time. And two, it tells us that they didn't like Alfred Morris or Zach Zenner enough to make them the focal point of the offensive game plan. In fact, Alfred Morris being inactive on Sunday was one of the more telling things, because in terms of talent, we've seen him be productive. He's a three-time 1,000-yard rusher. The fact that he was unable to even dress on Sunday was telling to me, especially since Zach Zenner didn't even play on special teams. I assumed the entire time that Zenner's addition was to replace DJ Foster on special teams, and he was the one that got snaps after Chase Edmonds. And so if neither DJ nor Edmonds are available, the Cardinals clearly were not comfortable moving forward with Alfred Morris and Zach Zenner. So, two things. One,
nor should they have been.
No,
I mean,
no.
That's just I mean, you're talking about, and I think this is important to understand. You're talking about a quarterback who is putting up numbers that will break a lot of records. You're talking about a quarterback that is clearly a budding star in the league. And so this is the roster you're running out there if you don't trade for Kenyon Drake. You're saying, hey, we want you to make plays surrounded by Zach Zenner, Alfred Morris, a 36-year-old Larry Fitzgerald, Christian Kirk, and one of Demir Byrd, Trent Sherfield. Like, those are your weapons. Oh, like, or 32-year-old Charles Clay.
And so, yeah. So like, the two things that this does is, one, you're going out and telling the team, one, we're still going to try. We're not going to just roll over. We're going to try. And it builds confidence in the locker room that the players see, hey, they acquired a player. That resonates. They don't care about draft picks. Players don't care about the future draft picks, especially late round picks, because those are guys that could replace players on the roster. But two, if they're looking to develop Kyler Murray, you have to have at least a threat of a running game. And Drake gives you that at least a little bit, because we've seen what happens offensively when it becomes completely reliant on the pass. The offensive line is good enough to run block and be adequate in passing, but if it's only passing, things get ugly quickly.
Right, and you look at who they're playing this week, and I know we're going to get to that, but if you're going to drop back 60 times in a game, I mean, we saw what happened against Carolina. We saw what happened against Washington. And Washington was played in like, that Washington game was played in like a hurricane. So this was a move that you just hope gives you some semblance of a kind of balanced offensive attack more than anything, because I mean, Nick Bosa, DeForest Buckner, Eric Armstead, when you kind of look at who the San Francisco 49ers are on paper, they're, you know, the best pass defense in the NFL. They only allow 128 yards per game. I mean, that's amazing. And so they only allow 11 points per game. They are, statistically speaking, you know, one of the best defenses ever through this point in the season. And the only reason you don't hear about it is because the New England Patriots are doing something at such a historical rate that's never even been seen before, that nobody else can get any run on about their defense. And so the 49ers are on pace to have three players with 10 sacks and then two additional players with 7+ sacks. That's just absurd to even think about.
It is. It is. And, you know, say what you want. It basically, if this ends up being a sixth round pick, it is the pick that the Cardinals acquired from the Patriots for Corey Cunningham. If you want to think of it that way, would you trade Corey Cunningham for Kenyon Drake even for half a season? Yeah. Who wouldn't? Unless you view Corey Cunningham as a future starter, which the Cardinals clearly did not, because had they not traded him, they would have cut him. That's a trade you make every single time. And especially if he ends up walking at the end of the year, then you're basically giving up a sixth-round pick for potentially a sixth- or seventh-round pick, compensatory pick in 2021. So, depending on how things play out in free agency, is it really that big a deal? No, it's not. And there is the potential for him being solid. After all, this was a guy that had over 1,000 yards from scrimmage, I think it was last year. And so he's clearly has some talent. He can catch the ball. He can make plays in the pass game. He can make plays in the running game. And so he makes a nice complement, at least a nice piece, in this particular offense, which, you know, a running back catching passes is kind of a good thing to have.
Yeah, and Drake is not a guy that is going to be simply a 1-2 game fill-in type guy. He's a guy that can be kind of the dual threat, along with whether it's David Johnson or Chase Edmonds, whoever's the healthiest. He's a guy that can create create in the open field. He's not a guy I would say is your daily lead back type of guy. But if you're talking about 1, 2, maybe 3 games of him being a lead back and getting 25 touches, I don't think it's a bad thing. And the thing is that he is a guy that has had success at a couple different ways, and that shows that he is somebody that can be continually effective, especially in an offense that lacks that. I mean, let's be honest. They don't have a bunch of guys that you're like, hey, this is a good lineup and good roster, right? So
coming on to the Rise Up C-Red podcast, we'll talk about the trades that didn't happen and maybe the trades that should have happened. That's coming up next on the Rise Up C-Red podcast. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast at this hour of Cardinals Talk on the web. So obviously, Kenyon Drake was the one trade that did make. There were a number of trades that they didn't make, and maybe they should have made. Seth, was there any particular deal out there or player available that you wish the Cardinals had done? I know it came out Patrick Peterson. The Cardinals took several calls. There were significant offers, but simply weren't interested in trading him. We've talked about this. Should the Cardinals have traded Patrick Peterson? 1, 2. Should they have made any moves for anyone else?
It's one of those things. I don't know what the reported rumors are that came out, but I'll say this. That trading Patrick is the right move in the sense of you have a guy that could return value, and that's the only way you trade him is if you're getting value in the pick. So if the Eagles say, hey, we'll give you a 1 and just throw a name out, Nelson Aguilar, which had allegedly been on the table from people I spoke with. You know, do you make that trade? If the Eagles don't make the playoffs, so you're looking at a top 20 pick, I mean, how would you feel about a top 20 pick for Patrick Peterson at this stage?
I wouldn't like it. simply because, but I'm also of the feeling that's like, how do you replace Patrick Peterson when he's right, your only talented defensive player in coverage?
And so that's the thing. I mean, if you get overwhelmed and they say, hey, you know, again, I'm just kind of spitballing. I don't really know what offers were out there. But if New England comes to you and says, hey, and obviously this was never going to happen, so I'm not saying it was on the table or viable. But if New England comes to you and says, hey, we'll give you our one, which is going to be 32, and N'Keal Harry. Okay, now maybe you start to listen, but you're talking, it has to be a significant trade. And if it's not a significant trade, then at that point it just doesn't make sense for the team, as you said, in the kind of long-term outlook of what they're trying to do. Because trading him now for a team that could make a playoff push versus maybe trading him in March or April when you know what draft pick you're getting, and, you know, say for, again, I'm just throwing teams out there. Say a team like the Texans come in, you know, they don't have any first round picks, so that probably doesn't work. But, you know, somebody like that, like the Chargers or the Raiders with one of their three first-round picks, and they come in and they say, hey, we'll give you our 12th pick for Patrick and then a 2021 second. That's probably better than getting a first for a potential playoff team, somebody that's looking to make a push. So I think that's part of the reason. The other reason is, and you kind of hit the nail on the head, they just don't have, I mean, if you know Robert Alford's coming back this game or next game, I guess technically is when he could come back, okay, maybe, but we really have no idea when Robert Alford's going to be back.
True. And there's one other thing for me as well. It depends on what you view Byron Murphy is moving forward. So maybe you take some lumps like you did for the first six games defensively, but if you see Byron Murphy as a top cornerback, as a top cover guy, it might be worth it because you've got your main cover guy and then you've got your complementary pieces and you can add to that. But there are so few players talented enough to replace a Patrick Peterson. Jalen Ramsey would have been kind of that guy to me. Other than that, why in the world would you do it? So unless you've got a Jalen Ramsey on your roster, why in the world would you trade away one of the most difficult positions to find?
You look at it, and I mean, would you, I mean, and again, this is a hypothetical, and obviously it would never have happened because the Rams are in the division, but like, would you have just done like a Marcus Peters and a fourth or a third for Patrick straight up? Like, those are like the questions, and I think you're saying all the right things about that. Like, it has to be the right return at the right time, and doing it now when you're 3-4-1, technically still in playoff chase, you're technically you are at a position where you don't have much talent at the cornerback spot right now. I just it doesn't make sense to me to just make that move. So I think they did the right thing, unless they were just overwhelmed with two first round picks like the Jags got for Jalen Ramsey. It doesn't make sense at this time.
Other deals though, Trent Williams, even though there's people out there saying that the Cardinals were kind of in the mix there, they were monitoring the situation, might have made sense, but now he's going back to Washington. He's reported. Players that really would have been nice fits, Leonard Williams.
The cost would have been prohibitive. Not what they gave up, though, to me,
yeah,
on that.
Well, that and what was it, Gambo was reported. They just didn't have the room for the cap this year, even.
I mean, you and I have talked about this quite a bit. When you look at cap, it's really not a real thing. So you can create space. Like, you could have restructured somebody or created space in the way if they really wanted to. So I think all things considered, they were probably interested at the right price. The Giants were just willing to pay a lot more than, I mean, you and I would have even thought to pay for, because here's the deal. If you give up a four, you're probably getting back a three in the offseason if you don't re-sign him. If you give up a three, you're going to get back a three, but it's guaranteed to be worse off than the three that you gave up, because it's going to be a comp pick. So unless you're the New England Patriots or the Saints or one of those teams, you're giving up a top 12 pick in the third round versus potentially the 100th pick overall. So you could be talking about a 30 spot differential depending on how many third round compensatory picks they give out. Right. And so for that reason, to me, it didn't make sense unless you had a off the record handshake deal. Hey, Leonard wants to re-sign in Arizona. So trade a third and then we'll get a deal done where, so, I mean, is, and that's the next question you ask, is Leonard Williams somebody you want to give a 4-year, $60 million deal to?
That is the thing. What about, say, Robbie Anderson? Would have been a really nice fit here, in terms of offensive scheme. But again, you kind of hit the same thing again. What do you give up, and what's it going to cost to bring him back? And just how does that move forward? Because obviously, putting him out on the field instead of a Demir Bird or Trent Sherfield is much more appealing, right?
Yeah, and the hard part with Robbie is why he was drafted late and why he had zero suitors when it kind of was all said and done. And that is, the talent has always been there, but there are apparently, and I didn't even know this, somebody texted me about it afterwards, there are apparently off-field concerns that go into, and not even like arrest or anything like that, but apparently he's kind of a headache to deal with. Shocking, a wide receiver being a headache. And so that is kind of where this all stemmed from, is that they were just hoping to get something because they think he's going to end up being a guy that goes on the restricted market. They put a second round tender on, and then they're able to just to kind of hold on to him because nobody's going to want to give up a second round pick. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And you might know this. I don't. How does that work if they're traded? Are they still restricted free agents and the new team can tender them?
Yes. Okay, so because it comes to the end of the year, if they have 3 years, doesn't matter if they were traded or not, as long as they were not terminated when their contract ends after year three, they're restricted. If it's after 4 years, they're unrestricted.
So yeah, so this would be year three, so he's restricted again. He's probably going to get tendered as a second. So if you were going to go get him, I guess that's what this would have been the time to do it. I don't know. And I'm not, I don't know Robbie Anderson at all. I don't have any insight to the Jets. I know, other than their entire franchise is a dumpster fire, but I do know somebody I trust told me that they have heard that there have been outbursts before. And like, that's the only way they put it. They even said it's like nothing that is hard to deal with if you're the the Saints or the San Francisco 49ers right now or the Packers, which is why it was odd that none of those teams made a run at him. But I guess that probably there might be some credence to that if those teams – I mean, the Packers desperately need wide receiver help. And if he was really only available for a fifth, you have to imagine that a team that has a quarterback – that is still one of the five best in the NFL, but is definitely on the backside of his career, you would think that they'd be like, hey, let's go all in for a guy like this, because Devontae Adams has been nicked up. They don't really have a ton past Devontae Adams. And so that was the interesting kind of thing to me, is that nobody wanted him. So I'm not trying to start a rumor. I'm not saying this is factual by any means, but it does make you wonder. There has to be more to it. Either they were asking for more, and that fifth round pick that was reported was to float to see if somebody would bite for like a fourth, or there are issues that we're just, whether you're media or fans, are not privy to, that make teams go, super talented, not the guy we want to deal with.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, what happened exactly against the Saints in that loss? We'll talk about that next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. The Cardinals, so they're moving on for the trade talk. We'll talk about some actual games that happened. The Cardinals lose 31-9 on Sunday against the New Orleans Saints. Offensively, they got completely shut down, something the Saints have been doing to pretty much everyone. They're held to, what, 237 yards total offense. They gave up a lot of yards to Drew Brees. 376 passing yards. Latavius Murray ran for over 100 yards. Michael Thomas went over for 100 yards. It was basically everything. So what happened, essentially? They're coming off three straight wins. They're running the ball super well. They're moving the ball offensively. They're doing some nice things defensively. They're getting a pass rush. What happened against the Saints?
I mean, do you want the long version or the short version? I think when you look at the long version of it, it's simply that the better team won out. I mean, the Cardinals had their shots. There was probably three or four plays that they should have hit that kind of changed the way the complexion of the game. And Vince Murata tweeted out about the long pass play to Charles Clay and talked about, you know, that was one of the longer pass plays of the season, and the Cardinals have never had a 100-yard receiving tight end, which is a baffling stat to me.
Since 1989, I believe it was Robbie Walt.
Yeah, and so you look at that and you say, oh, yeah, that's a great way to start the game. But in reality, if it's anybody but Charles Clay or Max Williams, they probably score a touchdown on that, right? and that's the thing. When you're playing a great team, and the New Orleans Saints are a great team. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from the Saints, because they are fantastic. You have to hit big plays. If you don't, then you're going to end up struggling. You know, nobody runs the ball against them. They're number two in yards given up all season. They're number 12 in yards given up against the pass. So when you kind of look at the long and short of it, the long of it is that the Cardinals just don't have the weapons to keep up, especially when David Johnson is out. You and I talked about this last week. He truly is, at this juncture, the only matchup advantage they possess outside. So when he's out, you have literally no wide receivers that create matchup issues. You have a bunch of good receiver or a couple good receivers and then a bunch of guys, but you know, and then you weren't going to be successful running the football on the Saints anyways. So it was, you know, kind of a hard thing on that. And then, you know, obviously Chase Edmonds goes down, and then it's basically, I mean, I tweeted out during the game, but it was the best call Kingsbury made all day when they pulled Kyler Murray with 5 minutes left, because you were at the point of the game where your only option to get back into it was to pass. And really, I mean, that was their only option the entire game. If they were going to win, they were going to throw for 500 yards. That's how you beat the Saints. It didn't work. And then Edmonds gets hurt, so then you're having a rookie trying to explain to Zach Zinner where to line up before anything happens. And so it just, you know, at the end, the better team won. And it wasn't that the Cardinals didn't have opportunities. They just continued to find ways to miss those opportunities and then compound it with other issues.
Right. There were a couple of things for me. Now, as I observed, as I pointed out last week, the Cardinals sitting at 3-3-1 before the Saints game, there's optimism. The problem was, if you looked at kind of how the division was, they were a 500 football team with a minus 31 point differential. And which kind of, if you believe the point differential, which is a pretty good measure of future success or the type of team you're going to be, what you have was a subpar team playing above its talent level for whatever reason. And we can point to, if there's one thing we can point to over the last few games as to why the Cardinals have been winning games, even with that negative point differential, it's because they haven't turned the ball over, which continues to be a thing. They're not turning the ball over, which makes things close. Now, against a team like the Saints, not only do you not have to take the ball, not turn the ball over, you've got to take the ball away and make plays. Offensively, they had some chances. If you want to kind of point to, the Charles Clay play, that was a big 47-yard play, but was not a touchdown. That's one thing that you've got to hit on. The throw to Larry Fitzgerald in the end zone should have been a touchdown. You know, it happens. He got pushed out, so he couldn't get that second foot down. But that's one of those things they've got to convert. That fateful fourth down play when they were at their 29, and then everything's kind of steamrolled after that. That was kind of the turning point of the game. You've kind of felt like the Cardinals are hanging on, but it doesn't feel like it's going to be like that for very much longer. And they go for it on fourth and one at their own 29-yard line, and they fail on that. I completely am okay with the decision. Obviously the play call didn't work. Maybe if you flip-flop them, you go with that run play on third down and then the cute pass on fourth down. Normally, based on what we've seen from them this year, they convert and then maybe something happens offensively. They didn't hit on those plays. And defensively, they played about as well as you could expect early on. They were fortunate that New Orleans missed a field goal, and that his time expired in the first half. The touchdown came off the board because of a holding penalty, and so it ended up being 10-6 at the half instead of being 20-6 at the half. And then things sort of fell apart because defensively, they really, schematically, it didn't look good because they were allowing them to just pick them apart. They did not challenge Michael Thomas. They gave up yards to Latavius Murray. Drew Brees picked him apart, and it got to the point while they did get one interception for Patrick Peterson, it was very clear that defense was not going to bend and not break the entire game. And then the floodgates opened in the fourth quarter.
And you and I talked about this before the show, and I think this is the testament to the good that Steve Keim has kind of done a little bit, and then the other side of it where Steve Keim and his issues have shown up so much. When you look at the Arizona Cardinals, if you just take their top 25 players, you know, the first, you know, 11 starters on offense and defense, and then let's just call it 28 for easy math, and say their top three subs on each side of the ball, they are not anywhere close to a top 15 team. But I don't think they're too far off a top 20 team. And I know there's only 32, so you're saying, okay, so they're one of the, you know, they're in the bottom third of the NFL. But they're probably in that 22 to 18 zone. Maybe creep up into 17, you know, by 16 by the end of the season type stuff. The problem becomes they're so thin that their top 28, even if you say that they're the 22nd or 23rd best team in the NFL with those guys, and that is a 9 to 10 spot improvement from last year. They're still 32, or one of those teams in the mix for 32 with the Bengals and the Dolphins and the Redskins and the Jets. When you get past their top 28, and I think we've seen that play out in the Giants game, in the Bengals game, and even the Falcons game. We've seen that play out where if everything is mostly good and mostly plays out in the no injuries, they're able to, you know, they're able to control the tempo of the game, they can win football games. It's when they have little to no help after their top two or three subs on defense and offense that things start happening. I mean, this week we talked about it. No David Johnson, so all of a sudden it's just Chase Edmonds. That's good enough to beat a New York Giants team. That's not good enough to even compete with a New Orleans Saints team. And I think that's where the difference is between where the Cardinals need to get to and where they were last year, if that makes sense. So is there improvement over last year? Absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. However, the improvement is within that first 25 to 28 guys. It's not in their entire 45 guy roster that could make it a play at any given time. Whereas the Saints, you know, they lose their starting center. They're without Alvin Kamara. They're without one of their tight ends. They're without one of their top cornerbacks, and they look that good. I mean, geez, Louise, like, where do you get these backups from, right? And so all of that happens, and you're like, this is still a great team. And the Cardinals start to lose people, or they have to lean on their depth a little more, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is still a bad team. And so that's, I think, to me, that's where the game is more won and lost than anything. If the Cardinals can front run a little bit and they don't have to reach deep into the depth of their talent, they're fine. As soon as they have to start weighing on the, you know, player 26 and 27, it's like, oh, things are going to get sideways. And we've just seen that. We have. I mean, and we've even seen it in the wins. That's why they give up those points late in the game, because their top players are playing. I mean, I know Corey Peters' agent. I know him. And their whole plan was that he was going to be like a 60% snap guy. He's at 70% of the snaps. And you might say that's only 10%, but that could be 8 to 10 snaps a game, and that's a huge difference for a guy that's 330 pounds that's ruptured both Achilles and that's 33 years old. I mean, that's a huge difference.
It is.
And where the Cardinals are losing are those 8 to 10 plays a game where he can't come out, or when he does come out, those other, you know, those other 30% of plays, so those other 20 plays where they have no chance of getting stops.
It's pretty much where we're sitting at as we're moving forward. Now, coming up to the Rise FC Red Podcast, talk about some of the playing time changes that we've seen defensively and even offensively, and what they mean moving forward. That's coming up next on Rise FC Red. We're back on the Rise FC Red Podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. It came out in the media on Tuesday. They talked about when Vance Joseph it wasn't Kingsbury's day to talk to the media. It was his coordinators, and one of the writers asked about the increase of playing time for Joe Walker, and Vance came out and made it known that Joe Walker had earned a spot on the base defense. Now, the truth is, I noticed this last week. When I wrote my article about the snap counts against the Giants, the problem was no one really noticed it, because the Cardinals were in base for literally only 6 snaps. But it's one of those things you can see when you kind of look at the pattern. So you look at Tremaine Brock now. When Tremaine Brock plays, he's nickel. So if someone plays the exact same number of snaps as him here, they're playing nickel. And if there's another guy that's playing in base, that's kind of that. So Joe Walker played 6 snaps against the Giants and Reddick played the other however many, 64, 65, maybe it was seven snaps on in nickel. And but it was noticed this last week because the Cardinals played base on 40 of the 76 snaps against the Saints. And so you saw a lot of Joe Walker. You saw not very much of Tremaine Brock. And, you know, and so what we've found is Hassan Reddick again appears to be going backwards into where he's supposed to be. Vance Joseph said that they're using Walker in base because of his experience, because he's been playing inside linebacker longer than Reddick, and he doesn't get fooled by the misdirection, jet sweep, jet motions, and things that offenses will do, particularly the 49ers will do, to try and move your eyes and deceive you and get you out of your gap. And so Reddick is going to be, for now moving forward, strictly nickel, where they can use his talents, where he can run with guys in coverage and he can hit and he can rush the passer. That said, how disappointing is it that he continues to, for lack of a better word, not progress from where he's, because basically he's doing the same thing that he's always doing. So he's not technically getting any better.
Right, and you and I were talking about this off the air, and it's that unfortunate reality of time when now you're on your third coaching staff, and I'm sure part of that doesn't help, but you're now on your third coaching staff that basically has, I mean, has given up the right word. I mean, they've basically said that we can't win with this guy, and so that really sucks. I mean, it really does, because when you look at it from a schematic standpoint, he's had James Betcher, he's had whoever the dude was at, with Steve Wilks last year, and then he's had Vance Joseph. Those are three different coaches, teaching techniques, schemes, being asked to play. Again, that probably didn't help, but it also means that there's three different coaching staffs that have gone, you know, and said, this is not a guy that I can consistently trust and win with. If you go back to our podcast, probably not draft night, I don't know if we ever do a podcast on draft night, but, you know, right around that, we were both, I wouldn't say ecstatic with the Reddick pick. You were happier because you called it than anything else. But, like, we both understood the pick.
Well, he was a perfect Steve Keim pick.
Right. We both understood the pick. Senior, super athletic, fantastic kind of leadership, attitude, skills. Something that they've been looking for in terms of, and I hate this term, but a football guy, like a guy that wants to learn and be part of football. But there was always a concern, and I expressed this to you leading up to the draft on draft night, ever since then. As great of an athlete as Reddick is, and there's zero that can be disputed about that. One of the biggest and most important things about playing linebacker is understanding what your eyes are telling you. And you cannot teach that. And that's just where Reddick is at this point. He's not a guy that understands his reads. He doesn't understand his keys. And part of that is simply he'd never played the position growing up. He was a, you know,
he was a defensive back in high school.
Right, he was a walk-on safety. Well, he was a safety first at Temple, too. Yeah. So, I mean, you have a guy that was a walk-on, scrawny kid, defensive back, safety in high school in his first year at Temple, bulks up, gets moved to a defensive end, and a you know, college-esque style attacking defense where he's not asked to do anything but, hey, go find ball, you know, off the edge. Size, prototype, speed, all of that fits the inside linebacker profile. The problem just becomes he's truly not an inside linebacker. And he never was. And so that's the thing. That's not his fault. I mean, what is he supposed to do? You know, be something he's not or has never done? And so that was always kind of my issue with the pick. And it's just come to pass that that was the reality of it. I mean, you go back.
The projection never happened. He was supposed to, because everyone was in love with what he did at the Senior Bowl. But the projection never actually moved forward. They saw the physical traits and the ability, and it just never translated the rest of it. Because when it comes to man coverage, he does okay. He gave up the touchdown to Murray in that game because he didn't use the right technique. He let Murray beat him outside when he had inside help.
Right. And I think what ends up happening, and this always happens, is that you look at the guys that could have been instead, and that's where you see kind of, you know, the problems that ended up happening, and you've got a guy like Zach Cunningham, who I, you know, that was my kind of favorite guy coming out at the inside linebacker position, because he was a true linebacker. I mean, that's all he did at Vanderbilt. That's what he played. You know, obviously he's injured this season, or he was injured last season, I believe. But, you know, you saw Duke Riley in the third round not be a bad pick. Alex Anzalone, he's a guy that has dealt with a ton of injuries as well. And so when you look at the linebacker position, it was always going to be either – it was either going to be Hassan Reddick or Reuben Foster in the first round. So I think you and I would both agree that they made the right call in not taking Reuben Foster because of all the off-field red flags. But it goes to show kind of the whole idea of when you draft for need, it's always going to...
It's going to bite you in the butt at some point.
Right. I don't want to say always, because that's hyperbole, but usually it's going to hurt. And the Cardinals came in, and everybody knew they needed inside linebacker. They desperately needed inside linebacker because Darren Buchanan was coming off his, you know, worst season as a pro, struggling with injuries. They didn't have, you know, Larry Foote was retiring, so they needed somebody to kind of pair with him. Or Larry Foote had retired the year before, so, you know, so it was kind of painting yourself into a corner, and it didn't work out. I mean, it is what it is at this point. I guess now the hope is that he can be a guy that gives you good snaps as a nickel linebacker and contributes on special teams, and he's going to be a guy that gets about, you know, in against most teams, he's going to give about 60% of the snaps, 40 to 60% of the snaps every game, I would say, depending on the team. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. He's still going to play significantly, but it's just showing that he isn't becoming exactly, and people use this as kind of a bust. It's not a bust,
It's the Levi Brown bust type thing, where they're NFL players. They are.
He never becomes what he's supposed to be.
Right. You'll never be able to justify the pick at this point.
Go ahead. That's the issue.
And that's what I was going to say. That's just the issue with that one.
We see some playing time on the offensive side. Keyshawn Johnson was a guy playing a whole bunch. His playing time has almost disappeared. He played really very, very few snaps against the Giants, was inactive against the Saints. It seems that things have slowed down for him a little bit in terms of production, or whether that's Trent Sherfield's work in practice, or simply that Damir Bird is back and they're using the tight ends more. Defensively, we see as well, it's kind of an interesting thing how they use the two Thompson safeties, the two rookies. They have now set roles. Jalen, the supplemental pick, he is a base safety, and Deontay Thompson, the kid out of Alabama, is a nickel safety. I honestly have not been able to see. I don't watch the defensive secondary in area as much. How do you see that playing out? Is that a good role for both of them in terms of the rotation? Is what does Jalen do better in base that Deontay isn't able to do, or perhaps it's more they want both to play, but they like Deontay more, a little more in coverage.
Yeah, it, you know, Deontay, we talked about it last week. It's interesting when they had Buddha in on that play against the Giants that game, because you see his shortcomings, right, as a true kind of single high guy playing center field. This is not what he's played, you know, similar to Reddick at the inside linebacker position. So he's a fish out of water and he's not as comfortable. He's not going to make the plays. Deontay is. That's kind of what he's done his whole career. That's who he was at Alabama, and he was really freaking good at it. I mean, he was the guy that was talked about as a first-round pick coming in to the 2018 season for a lot of the season until the knee issue came up, right? So when you look at it, that's his best use. Jalen's more – we talked about it when they drafted him. He's kind of Buddha light, as in kind of a box safety dime slot guy that can run and cover a little bit better. And so it's interesting that you're splitting those roles, and because now I assume teams know what you're doing. I mean, obviously they're not playing, they're not going off like cover three or cover one, depending on what the call is. Because you're seeing Buddha play that center field position when Jalen comes in, and that is more to me what the issue is than anything. It's not that they're rotating Jalen and Deontay. It's that they're technically rotating Buddha and Deontay, or Buddha and Jalen, but Buddha never comes off the field, if that makes sense. So technically, yes, they're rotating the rookies, but the way they're doing it, they're actually rotating Buddha, asking him to play two different safety positions in the same game. And when he's in with Jalen, typically that's when you see the big plays happen, because Jalen's not as good as Buddha. Not shocking, I know. And Buddha is not a natural at free safety. So he's probably not even as good as Deontay. So it does kind of beg the question of why are we just not seeing Deontay and Buddha all the time, and then Jalen maybe coming in for snaps. But, you know, who am I to judge?
And for me, the interesting thing is just how the offensive is evolving. They use the tight ends much, much more than they did at the beginning of the year. And part of that is simply because they're not getting good enough play from the receivers. And it gives them the flexibility. Let's kind of move from there. Coming up next on Rise to See Red, we'll do a little bit of some mid-season evaluations before we talk about, briefly, the 49ers game. So, evaluations coming up. That's coming up next on Rise to See Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour Cardinals talk on the web. Midseason evaluations. Let's kind of start with the coaching. How would you evaluate the coaching so far? And I think offensively, I am pleased with what we're seeing overall, especially from Kingsbury. Defensively, I have some questions schematically about Vance Joseph's decisions and rotations and things like that. What do you think of the coaching so far?
I think offensively we've seen the growth of this team. You know, and people take that the wrong way, because they go, well, I mean, they're not good. Just counting stats wise, they're 20th in scoring, but they're up 8 points a game. I mean, that's a lot. That's a touchdown a game. You know, offensively passing, they're 19th in yards. Rushing, they're 14th in yards. You know, they're 9th in yards per average. A lot of that is, you know, Murray's presence. They've created more scoring opportunities. They're 11th in scoring percentage, which is great to see. You know, their time of possession is is better. So they're improving in every situation. And you look at it, and you know, we kind of talked about this at the beginning of the show. It's not exactly like they're running out a super talented team. I mean, there's still a ton of issues on this team, and so you have a team that's improved quite a bit, while maybe not really having improved in terms of maybe, you know, talent-wise. So the schemes are doing a lot, and I think that's, to me, that's a big thing.
And one of the most impressive things, if you look at it, I saw this tweet from Kyle Odegaard at the Cardinals, azcardinals.com, and he was quoting, he was citing Football Outsiders. Their offense last year was 40%, like more than almost 41% below average. Their offense this year is like more than 1% above average. That's significant. Now, defensively, that's another story. They haven't done much improvement. Part of that was handcuffed without Patrick Peterson, but they seem to be getting the pass rush back going. They didn't have a major problem with that last year. They got some contributions inside and outside from guys other than Chandler Jones. So the pass rush is okay, but the run defense is no better. Not really. Coverage is the pass defense is definitely not better. They're giving up massive amounts of yards. They're better defensively against scoring, but they're just, I don't know how much to think, but I'm not happy with how the defense is playing, especially because they're putting more pressure on a young offense to perform. And the defense was supposed to be the stabilizing point, I think, because that's why they brought in all those veterans for Vance Joseph to use, who'd worked with him in his system.
Yeah, and you look at it, you know, last year they were 32nd across the board in passing defense. I mean, or in defense, they just weren't very good, like you said. I mean, and so that creates an issue. Their pass defense last year wasn't awful, but I mean, their run defense last year, they gave up almost 2,500 yards rushing. You know, they're halfway through the season this year, and they're on pace to give up 2,000 yards rushing. So, I mean, 500 less yards rushing, that's pretty good. You know, but they're on pace to give up 1,200 more passing yards. They're on pace to give up the most passing touchdowns in the NFL. So, I think when you kind of look at the defense, it goes back to what we talked about before. Talent-wise, there's not a whole lot. Patrick being back helps. They didn't get what they expected from Hassan Reddick, but they also didn't get what they expected from Darius Falon. You know, he didn't even play a snap. You've got Zach Allen, who hasn't been in since, was it game, like first series of game three?
Something like that.
So you've basically got nothing from your third-round rookie. It's just tough. Robert Alford's obviously been out all year. So DJ Swearinger was cut because he was so awful. Well, so, I mean,
there are some good things, though. Look at the quarterback play. I mean, you look at what expectations were on Kyler Murray. You can't be disappointed, really, at all. He's been solid and too even good.
I would say he's been very good. I think that's a fair statement in terms of how he's played this year.
The rushing attack overall significantly better, but it's inconsistent. But that's better than just terrible,
right? And I think a lot of that inconsistency stems from lack of talent along the offensive line. I think a lot of that inconsistency also stems from the fact that they don't have, or they didn't utilize Chase Edmonds as much as they probably should have. That's just, you know, my opinion on things. But when you look at the season overall, I think the good outweighs the bad when you just look at it from the position of last season. And that was kind of what we talked about from the beginning, is this season had to just be an improvement over last season. That's all that mattered. And I know that's a really low bar, but you look at what this league is right now, and there are a number of teams that are, you know, as bad, probably, maybe worse than the Arizona Cardinals last year. So when you look at it from that perspective, they've improved, and that is what really matters.
Right. And you know, I put this out there on Twitter after the game. So those three straight wins, it tells us one thing. They're not a bad team anymore. They're not a good team, but they're not a bad team. They're an improving team. They're not a good team. They're not, maybe that's it. They're not a terrible team, which was that they were last year. They were unwatchable. They were awful. Bad teams don't win three games in a row. Bad teams will win two out of three, will win one out of three, but they don't win three in a row, including two on the road. So I think we've moved up to the next notch of being passable and improving. And, you know, even though it feels a little disappointing that they're not better than 3-4-1, did we really think they were going to be any better than 3-4-1 at the midpoint of the season? Three wins in the first eight games, maybe 4-4. That's probably where everyone was optimistically planning on it being. And we'll see what happens moving forward.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that, you know, you can look at too is that you want to look at Kyler and you're saying to yourself, okay, is this a guy that you can build around? So, and obviously the season's not over, so there's still time for him to improve or kind of fall below this. But, you know, when you look at quarterbacks, and specifically rookie quarterbacks over the last 50 years, the number of quarterbacks with an 80% – or, sorry, a passer rating of 80 or higher as a true rookie first-year player is – absurdly low. Obviously, I took out kind of guys that threw, you know, 100 passes or whatever. But so guys over 250 passes in their rookie season. You look at the list, and it's a good list to be a part of. I mean, there are obviously some outliers, and then there's names I'm not even sure I know. But, you know, you look at it and you kind of get comfortable with where he's at. And then, you know, even if you skew that down more and say to 85, that list gets even smaller. I mean, there's 12 players. There's 20 players with a passer rating of 80 or better in their rookie season. There's only 12 with 85 or better. So, I mean, and if he, you know, he's probably not going to put up great numbers against the 49ers in their two games that they play. But outside of that, I mean, there's a lot of bad defenses he's going to face that he's going to be able to kind of pad those numbers and get better on. And so I think that's a big thing too. And you look at it, the first four games, he was sacked
20 times.
He's been sacked six times since then. That's really, really awesome. And that's a combination of both of them. I mean, the offensive line's playing better. Cliff is calling a better game. And Kyler's more cognizant and able to recognize. We've seen him bail out his offensive tackles.
Many times.
Many times the last two games. DJ and Justin Murray both. And then last week we saw him bail out his offensive tackle twice and then throw the ball away. Well, technically one was a shot down the field that he underthrew, but I mean, he didn't force a throw or take a bad, like, non-contact sack, right? So, like, again, you're seeing improvement week to week, you're seeing growth, and I think that's kind of what matters in the end here this season. That was really always what mattered in this season, so I think at the midway point, you are worried more about the defense than anything else. And when you're saying that with a rookie head coach that had a ton of question marks and maybe even red flags, and then a rookie quarterback with the same, I think that you have to be cautiously optimistic for the future.
Coming next on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, our final segment, we'll talk about the game against the 49ers. What exactly do they have to do to win that game? That's kind of next on Rise Up C-Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Cardinals play Thursday night, host the San Francisco 49ers. Undefeated San Francisco 49ers who are playing out of their minds defensively. They have a running attack that is enviable. Vance Joseph called them a 40-run, 20-pass team. And they've got Jimmy Garoppolo not messing things up. What do the Cardinals have to do to beat them? Because this seems, especially, they're not going to have David Johnson. They're not going to have Chase Edmonds. So we're talking Kenyon Drake and Alfred Morris as your running backs. Maybe Mason Cole or Joshua Miles at right tackle to try and deal with Mr. Nick Bosa. And then you have a defense that's not particularly great at stopping the run or tight ends, and they've got a good running attack and George Kittle. Is there any hope for a win? I'm not optimistic, and I'm actually going to pick the Cardinals to that. I'm actually going to pick the 49ers to cover this game, but I think it might be one of those games that slowly gets away from them. Like, it's a competitive game that slowly gets away. Now, what do they need to win? Obviously, they need to be balanced offensively. They need to take the ball away and take care of the ball. But somehow, they need to limit their running game.
Yeah, and that's the biggest thing. You want to force Jimmy Garoppolo to throw the football. You talk about guys that have kind of, or teams that have won in spite, and I know that they're scoring a ton of points per game, third in points per game at 29.6, but, you know, they're second in points allowed at 11, which would be just insane. Jimmy's not playing great. He's thrown 7 interceptions on the season. He completes a really high percentage of his passes, and Kyle Shanahan is a master at creating windows and throws for everybody. I mean, it's not just Jimmy that he did that for, so, or does that for. So, I mean, you look what the heck he did with Nick Mullins. So when you look at it, the key to this game is really asking Jimmy Garoppolo to beat you. And as we talked about earlier, the Cardinals are more than able to allow Jimmy Garoppolo to beat them. And so I think that's kind of the key to this game, is if you can stop Tevin Coleman, because it sounds like Matt Breida and who's Raheem Mostert, neither of them will play in this game. At least that's kind of what it sounds like. You have to be excited about that fact. Kyle Juszczyk is out as well, and he's a huge, huge piece to their offense. So there's a good chance that you could see this team be able to stop the run. I'm not going to say it's going to happen, because this is one of the best rushing teams in the NFL. Or from a yardage standpoint, they're second. You know, attempt standpoint, they're first. That's always impressive when you're 1-2 in attempts and yards, because that means your ground game is really good. They're first in rushing touchdowns, you know, and then you look at it, they're 31st in passing attempts. They don't throw the ball a ton, 24th in yards. So again, if the easiest is obviously the wrong word, but the most likely way to beat this team is to force Jimmy Garoppolo to beat you. And that's super easy when you talk about it. It's incredibly difficult to actually go out there and do. So those are, you know, that's the thing. Defensively, they're phenomenal. We talked about it earlier. They have two guys that are almost at 10 sacks. They have four guys that could end up with 7 sacks or more on the season. Those are insane numbers when you look at it. Their defensive line is phenomenal. D Ford is questionable. He's their, you know, second dairy pass rusher off of Nick Bosa. Maybe that works out. They're missing both of their starting tackles, but they've still been great without them. So, I mean, you know, what does that tell you? I think the biggest loss, and he's going to play, but the biggest loss for the 49ers would be George Kittle. If he was out, he's been limited with a groin issue. That could be kind of the potential thing. I just don't see it. I mean, it's all wishful thinking.
Basically,
that's my point. Like,
yeah. Well, and then we talked about before the show started. It basically the best hope that the Cardinals have is that it's a poorly played football game, that between the 49ers not having their full running attack and the Cardinals not having much of a running attack, that it turns into lackluster football, which makes the game close, which leaves a potential for big plays late and things
right.
happening and things like that. So yeah, so basically for the Cardinals to win, we're hoping for a terrible football game. Yay.
And here's the thing, even if you lose, you know, like 30-20, that would be tied for the most points that this team's given up all season.
It's true.
So, I mean, they haven't played a ton of teams that are great outside of maybe the Rams, but they just don't give up points, and that's going to be what's really. Basically, it comes down to this. If the Cardinals get into the red zone, they have to score touchdowns. If they settle for three, you know, for field goals again, it won't matter. Like, they're not going to be able to keep pace. And so I just don't know, against a team that's allowing 11 points in the season, if they're going to be able to score touchdowns. And that's just where they are as a team right now.
And with that, we will wrap up this edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. This is episode 245. We'll be back again next week, and we can talk about what happened in this Thursday night game. Enjoy the weekend, guys, because Cardinals take care of their game on Thursday. That means things opened up for everyone else. You can watch other games. You can take it easy. ASU's not playing this weekend either, so it's kind of a football-free weekend. So if you can watch whatever games you want without having to get mad at what's happening. So with that, we'll end the show. That's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Root. Thanks for listening. We will be back again next week. Go Cardinals.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms, so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up Sea Red.
Whoa!